Welcome to an Arsenal podcast, The Clock and Talk. I'm your host, Tez. Join myself, Tony, Carl, Schmidt and Savvy as we talk Arsenal. Thank you for listening, thank you for downloading and with us here of another Arsenal podcast, The Clock and Talk. This week, we're snuck in on yous all because we thought we were going to have a bit of a break over Christmas, but me and the boys got together and we thought, well, why not? Let's do it. So we apologise, though, because it's going to be uploaded right before the Liverpool game. So anyway, some things we say mightn't reflect on what will actually happen. If it changes, it's not our fault. Okay, so Tony, how are you, mate?
Yeah, I'm good, thanks. Yourself?
Yeah, good, buddy, good. And Schwinn, you're with us too, buddy. How are you?
Yeah, I am. I'm shaking a little bit. I'm really looking forward to the game today with a lot of excitement, so I'm absolutely buzzing.
Yeah, same, mate. I hope. What was your prediction last podcast?
I went for a tactical 1-1, and I still believe that it's going to be pretty gridlocked, but I think we're going to see some special moments, so I'm super excited for today's game, because if I'm proven wrong with my prediction, then at least we have an attacking and a very end-to-end game.
Yeah, I think I went a 3-2, so yeah, we'll see. And Tony, you went a 10-0 or something, didn't you?
Yeah, 10-0, standard.
As standard. Okay, righto, let's get on to, we had a game midweek, Carabao Cup, West Ham game. Mate, I didn't really catch this game, guys, so you're going to have to tell me what actually went on. Tony.
Yeah, win's a win in a cup tournament. It's similar to what I said against Newcastle. Again, this time of year, performance isn't the key indicator. The result is, and it was a horrible game. There was only one shot on target between both teams during the game. We were a much better team. We controlled the ball, dominated the ball, but didn't really create much. But we got through to the next round, and that's what cup competition's about. Give me a 1-0 in every game in the cup with a terrible performance, and you win the cup. So it's fine by me. But yeah, the game, there's not much to really say. Ospina didn't make a save. They only had one shot off target. We had quite a few off target and one on. And should have had a penalty probably. But yeah, apart from that, there's not really much to say.
When we were doing the men of the matches, it was a bit hard to try and get a couple of names out. I think Chambers come to mind. Welbeck scored the goal, so he got thrown in. Who else was there that had a standout game?
For me, I mean, like, obviously in our group chat, I think it was you that asked, and I said between Chambers and Holding, I thought, because West Ham weren't at full strength, but they started with Ayew, who was obviously they paid £20 million for, and Chicharito, who is seen as a maybe not world-class striker, but the level below, the top-draw striker, and they dealt with them absolutely no problems. And then when Andy Carroll came on and Arnautovic, people thought, oh, here we go, here comes problems, a bit of pace, a bit of aerial strength, and literally, West Ham still didn't have a sniff. So they've still, although West Ham may have not been at full strength, and we definitely weren't, they've still dealt with top draw attackers. So for me, I would go for them too. I went with Chambers just because he was a little bit more composed on the ball and he looked a bit more assured. Mm-hmm. I haven't seen the stats, but he seemed to give the ball away less, maybe just because he was playing easier passes. But he just seemed like the more assured of the two. But I would have been happy to see either of them to get it.
Debuchy, how'd he go?
Yeah, he was good. He was a bit sloppy at times early on. He also, because he played at right back, it meant getting up and down more than he has, obviously, when he's been playing at right centre back. So he did look to tire towards the end, just because of the amount of distance he had to cover compared to what he's been used to recently. But pretty solid game.
Yeah, cool. Okay. Schwinn, what was your take on it all, mate?
Similar. 1-0 win, scrappy goal. Danny Welbeck has this amazing ability of making things that are very easy seem very difficult. But at the same time, he does put it in the back of the net, so no complaints from me. There was a penalty shout that Tony said later on into the game. On first look, it felt like it was absolutely in the box. I haven't seen any more replays, so I couldn't tell you with 100% certainty, but instinctively, I shouted penalty. But it wasn't given. I think a free kick was given from the outside. I think the main takeaway, well, not the main takeaway, but two takeaways from this game for me were how good Chambers was, as Tony touched upon. And I was also very impressed by Woolock. I thought he was very calm in possession. The West Ham midfielders were triggered the press as soon as he would get the ball, but he was very, very calm in holding on to the ball, looking around, and either playing a forward pass if it was on, or retreating and giving it back to one of our defenders. So I really liked the shift he put in. Initially, when the Arsenal Twitter handle put out the team, it showed him as number 10, but in all reality, the three midfielders, more so Elneny and Woolock, were sort of on the left and the right, and they would switch, and Coquelin was mostly in the center. Coquelin had a decent game too. He showed some football anatomy that day. Some using his feet well. Some good passes from the outside of the foot. Some good low driven balls which were horizontal, which are always difficult to play because if someone latches onto that, then you've just exposed a massive hole. So I thought Coquelin had a decent game. But the biggest takeaway for me was Giroud's injury, which I think we should talk about a little more because there's been a lot of discussion about how Giroud's injury is sort of a blessing because that means Lacazette is going to play more. I find that so preposterous and so ugly if an Arsenal fan is sort of partaking in that because one must realize that Giroud is one of those strikers that you can bring on from your bench and he can completely change the dynamic of your team. Not a lot of Premier League teams have that luxury. And Giroud is a very, very good player. He might not be a Lewandowski. Well, he's definitely not a Lewandowski. But he provides another dimension and a good quality to that dimension. So when we have Lacazette starting and when we bring on Giroud, it brings something new to the team. And I think we're going to miss him. I'm just glad and I hope it's not too long of an injury. But I think we're going to miss him in this congested period.
Yeah, I agree with you. I did see a couple of people tweeting that Giroud, due to his injury, Lacazette will play a full game. And I totally agree. Like, any fucking fan out there who wishes a player is injured so another player gets a start, I'm sorry, but you're not a fucking fan in my mind. We can sit here and talk about Elneny. I'm not his biggest fan, but I would never, ever wish Elneny to get injured so another player could start.
Yeah, I mean, let alone injured, even having a bad performance. I mean, everyone has their own personal favorite. So, for example, if I like Mesut Ozil more than Jack Wilshere, and if Jack Wilshere is playing in a Premier League game, I'm not going to wish that Jack Wilshere doesn't play well because that would mean Mesut Ozil's position then comes under jeopardy. No, competition is healthy, and this fire that Lacazette has now, that Arsene Wenger has probably built up, and Lacazette is a good thing. You know, that sort of gesticulation that we saw last game out in the Premier League when Lacazette threw his gloves onto the bench, there might be many reasons to that frustration, but one has to be that, he's being subbed off, and that is going to give him a boost. He will try and do better in training. Mm-hmm. And let's not forget that Kolasinac and Lacazette are still new to the Premier League. And this time of the year, usually they have time off for the vacations. So, I mean, there's a lot of man management here. But at the same time, just to expect that sort of conflict within your own squad is counterproductive. And that does no one any good other than your own personal ego.
Yeah, I agree. I just with Kolasinac, he had time off in the German league this time last year, but and we'll go into it because Tony wants to talk a little bit more about him. I'm sorry, but you're getting paid good money, so mate, fucking you can play. I don't know, is Wenger resting him or what?
I think so. I mean, when Mesut Ozil came to this league, the first season in here, he did the same thing. He sort of gave him a breather. But then again, Mesut Ozil gets a breather even now. I'm not sure. I mean, I can't say with certainty, but that's what I feel. This also could be a change in the pecking order with Ainsley Maitland-Niles sort of making that position his own. So it's tough for me to say indefinitely. But I have a feeling that it has a little bit to do with that. And the fact that Kolasinac's dip in form also came about during this time, I think, is sort of worked into that whole equation. But there's no denying that these players are not used to playing during this time of the year. So I think it's not the worst thing to rotate your players if you think that their muscle might not be able to take it, because losing them would be a much bigger blow. Other than, you know, just playing them in a game and or not having them in a game and dropping points, because there's so many games coming up in the next, you know, 8 weeks that we would rather have a rotated squad than a forcibly rotated squad.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's segue into that with Tony. Your take on Klasnac, mate?
Just before I get onto Klasnac, just my 2 cents on the Giroud thing.
Oh, yep. Sorry.
Everyone moans at players not having competition, so they go, oh, Hector's sitting too comfortable because he's got no one behind him, and Xhaka's another person that they've had that same criticism labelled, oh, he knows he's not going to get dropped. So Lacazette has competition, and now everyone wants him to not be competition. Mm. And then if Lacazette's crap for 3 weeks, they'll go, oh, it's because he faced no threat. You can't win.
That's the
problem with fans, yeah. I'm mainly involved with Arsenal fans, so I'll say the problem with Arsenal fans, it probably is a football-wide problem, but is that when someone's got no competition, they moan that, oh, the player's too comfortable. When someone has got competition, they want them to get injured so they don't have competition. It doesn't make sense. I mean, it does make sense and it doesn't make sense at the same time.
But what's your take on it? Am I being a bit harsh by saying, like, you know, what I said?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I always steer clear of saying someone isn't a fan, because who am I to judge what a fan is and what isn't? Mm. I know the standards I set for myself, but that doesn't mean everyone lives to the same standards, and that's in every walk of life, not just football. Mm. But no, I agree. I don't ever want to see a player get injured. Mm. Obviously, do we want players dropped from time to time? Yes, but do we want players injured? And as I said, especially when it is someone like Giroud who gives us another option, like, I think people are looking at the price tag with Lacazette and not always what he's doing. I'm a fan. I've said that. I've been converted because I didn't really... What we signed, I wasn't really happy with. But I think he's improved a hell of a lot, or he's shown more than I thought he had. But Giroud, one, offers something different. And two, Lacazette... It's not like Lacazette's been brilliant in every game and got subbed off after 70 minutes. Against Newcastle, he was not very good. Against Southampton, he was completely ineffective. He comes off and Giroud comes on and scores. And it's not like he would have scored that goal had he been on the pitch. The goal Giroud scored, Lacazette could never have scored. And obviously that could happen vice versa. There's goals that Lacazette will score that Giroud would never have scored. So it works both ways. But it's not like they're the exact same player. They offer very different things. I just think it's crazy. And I said, people looking at the price tag with Lacazette and going, oh, we can't drop this £50 million player. Well, if it's £50 million player's not doing the job, he's got to come off. Like, you can't think, oh, well, he's £50 million, we've got to keep him on. If he's not doing what he's there for, then he has to come off, surely. That's logic.
I had an interesting conversation today. The Lacazette thing, is it because of what Sanchez is creating on that left? I'll rephrase that. Not creating balls for Lacazette into the centre.
No, I wouldn't say so. I think... You can't label on one player. Look, I've said this many times. At the moment, we're in a position where we're blaming everything on Sanchez. We can see the corner, and somehow it's Sanchez's fault. Yeah. And I'm not his biggest fan, and I don't want him at the club, as I've said on pretty much every podcast since we started doing podcasts.
Yeah.
But that, I think, and I've said this before, I think we are going over the top with laying the blame for absolutely everything at his feet. You can put it down to that. A lot of times we've been playing with deep defences, playing against us. And he's been trying to create stuff. I mean, look, since, say, the last 4 games, when, like, so it was West Ham, I know you because of the sub, Newcastle, Southampton, he didn't score the last 3 games, sorry. And you say, oh, is it due to a lack of Sanchez not being creative? But we've only scored 2 goals in them games. Mm. So you can't blame Sanchez for that. You could, and look, Ozil's been very good, but you could go a step further and say, well, Ozil's a creative player. He hasn't created anything. He scored one of them goals. So, in essence, we've scored 1 goal that's had nothing to do with Mesut Ozil, and Sanchez created that. So, the criticism could be similar if you're looking at stats. As I always say, watch football with your eyes and you'll see a different story.
Yeah.
But I think with you saying, and you saying you have a conversation that is Lacazette's dry spell or not being too good of recent times down to Sanchez? Absolutely not.
Just the conversation come up that... he was obviously a better player at Lyon, and I thought, well, and I looked at the team there, and I thought, what are we doing different that they were doing?
Playing in a harder league.
That's about all it comes down to, you think?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, look, I don't know. I'm assuming they came third last season, Lyon. I'm not 100%. They might have come fourth behind Nice. But they're still, either way, whether they came third or fourth, they came higher than we finished in the Premier League last year. So you would say they're a better team in that league than we are in our league. Mm. They're more competitive. Then you look down the league and you look at the quality of the Premier League, that the 20th team in the Premier League would probably come 10th in France. Mm. So you're looking at, it's a harder league in that sense. And then you've also got to look at, he'd been there for however many years. He was settled there. Mm. Here he's played, what, 10, 12, 15 games? So, again, it's a factor of things. But look, the French league is easier. There's no two ways about that. And he knew the league inside out. He could play against the centre-back and tell you everything that they could do, what they were strong at, what they were weak at. Mm. And I know you can do as much scouting as you want, but until you've actually played against a player, things are different. Like, you might know, you might watch videos and say, oh, this guy's quick. But until you've run alongside them, there's levels of quick. We all know that. And until you've run alongside them, you'll never be able to gauge that. So every player he would have played against, he would have known them inside out. Whereas here, he's coming up against players and he may have seen them on video. He may not have. But he definitely will be learning by playing against them. It's what I mean. Second season syndrome is a phrase that's brought up quite a lot, where a player does quite well in their first year and then struggles in their second year. And that tends to be because the defenders now know what they do. As I said, they may have seen what they're good at, but they've never actually faced it. And once they've faced it, they can learn to play against it.
Mm. Well, you only have to look at Memphis Depay. He wasn't really good at Manchester United, but then he went to... he's at Lyon now and carving it up in the French league, so I suppose what you say is, yeah. Okay, do you want to touch on Klozinac?
Yeah, so I think we received a question from Texas Guna, I believe, and I wanted to answer it, but I feel it's going to obviously come into what we were talking about during when we mentioned the Liverpool game anyway, so I thought I might as well, instead of waiting for the questions at the end, just bring it up now. I'm just trying to find the exact question because I had a direct answer to it.
That's all right. While you're having a look at that, you can follow us on. You got it?
So he said, this is based on the premise that Kolasinac won't play against Liverpool because he played in midweek. If we go over back four and Mustafi is fit, will Nacho play at left back, or will he keep Koscielny and Nacho in the middle and play Maitland-Niles at left back? What do I prefer in terms of a three or a four at the back? So for me, the first thing is, Kolasinac has never started in a four for us. We've switched during games and he's become a left back. And I think when he came on against Cologne at half time in the home game, we went to a back four. But he's never started. He's never played 90 minutes at left back. My theory is, and it could be completely wrong, it's just something I've observed while watching, I think he'll start tonight. I think he dropped it. So the two games he's been dropped for, arrested, however you want to call it, were West Ham and Newcastle, both when we played four at the back. Mm. And I think he's used the West Ham game the other day as a to get him used to playing in the back four with us, because we all know he's got his fitness issues. He can't get up and down for 90 minutes. We'd often seen him in a back five. He'll get forward and not back. And then the opposite game of that was Tottenham, when he didn't really get forward but stayed back, or more so. So I think the game on Tuesday was a test for him to see, can you do it in a back four in this team, in this league? I know he played there for Schalke and he got in the team of the year, but as I said, in this team, in this league, can he do it? Mm. And I think it was a bit like an audition, and he wasn't faced with much. He didn't get forward as much as he has done in the back five, which is pretty obvious. But I think that was more of an audition, and I think he will probably play today, and I think we'll play in a back four. But again, it's just something I've observed. It's not fact. It's not anything. It's
so
just,
you've got him on left back?
Yeah.
Yep. Okay. So Maitland-Niles, he doesn't get a run at all.
No, for me, he's not in the team. Nothing against him. I think he's actually been very good in the two games he's played, but I personally wouldn't be confident with him up against Salah or Mane, either one. And he's not. Both the games he's played, the games with dominating the ball, we've not really been attacked too much. He's not actually had to do much defensively, and that will not be the case tonight. So I would be surprised if he played. I'd be very surprised, to be honest.
Oh, well, since we're talking teams, let's give us your predicted lineup for tonight.
So personally, I would go back to a back five, but I don't think he will. I think he'll go with Cech, Kolasinac, Monreal, Koscielny, Hector, Xhaka, Wilshere, Alexis, Ozil. He'll go over Wobi because it's a big game, and then Lacazette up front.
Okay.
That's not what I would do. That's what I think Wenger will do.
That's your predicted lineup, or that's what you think he'll do. Yep, okay. What would you do?
I'd go five at the back, especially if Mustafi is fit. Obviously, from the outside, we'll never know that. I know he's back in training, so people might think he's fit, but unless you're with the players day in, day out, there's levels of fitness, as we all know. But assuming he's fit, which Wenger said he is, I would go Cech in goal, Kolasinac left wing back, Nacho, Koscielny, Mustafi, with Mustafi in the middle of the three, Hector at right wing back. As much as I've criticised him, I don't think the Bushi is ready to come in at a game of this size at wing back. In the middle, it would be Jack and Xhaka. And then Ozil. It's a difficult one because Iwobi offers no threat but offers a good pressing. And then Welbeck is probably more of a threat, but not on the wing. So I would go Welbeck, Lacazette. But again, if Wenger was to do that, he'd go Iwobi, I think.
Okay. Right, Ashwin, you want any to add on any of that, mate?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to add on the lineup as well. I think it's going to be a back five. I mean, I want a back five, but I think the switch to a back four has been made. I think just like last season when we started with a back four, we switched to a back five to give ourselves something new, something that we lacked in defense.
When was the last time we played a back five?
About 2 weeks ago, I think the game before the West Ham game, which was at the London Stadium.
Against Southampton. Okay.
Southampton, I think that's right. So I think last season, this is what we did. When we switched to a back five, it was because of our defensive mistakes. Now we are lacking a little bit in offense, I would argue, because our midfield is a little broken. So that's why the switch was made to a back four. Of course, injuries played a part in that. But I think now Wenger has sort of switched to a back four, and I think we will see a back four tonight. But I want to see a back five, as Tony said. I think they have a lot of firepower. And if Kolasinac, whoever plays left wing back, I want it to be Kolasinac too. But whoever plays left wing back needs support from another center back, and that support will be more abundant if you're playing a back five. Mohamed Salah is on fire. The man cannot stop scoring, and more importantly, the man cannot stop scoring FIFA goals. You know, he's scoring absolutely absurd goals. So we need to support Kolasinac. As Tony said, his recovery is not necessarily the best. So if he is sitting back a little bit, like he did in the Tottenham game, then maybe it's a little better, and maybe Salah can be neutralized. But still, he needs a little bit of a backup, if Salah does get goal side. But
so
yeah,
your predicted lineup similar to Tony's?
Well, my predicted lineup would be a back four. I want to start a back five, though.
Okay.
I think it's going to be a back four with the Kolasinac at left back. I think Nacho Monreal misses out, and Mustafi and Koscielny in the middle of the defense with Bellerin on the right. Xhaka, Jack in the middle of the park with Mesut, Iwobi, and Alexis right behind Lacazette is what I would imagine Wenger is going to do. But I would personally start a back five just to give us that defensive edge, because this is a classic six-pointer considering how close we are in the table. So I would rather go for a draw than for a loss. Not in terms of starting the game, but at the end of the game, I would rather have a draw than a loss more than any other game at this point, I would say.
Would you like a you know, we really opened up at Manchester United how we didn't score. Well, we scored the one, but too late and everything. But would you like an open game like that, or you like us to be more defensive?
The latter.
Yeah.
I would like us to be more defensive. I'm not trying to say that we should park the bus. Arsene Wenger doesn't have that in his DNA. But we have the quality and the threat on the offense that even if we are not dominating in terms of possession, then our front three or front four can bring something to that to that avail, rather than being camped in their half and then having Liverpool counter us. So I would expect us to be defensively solid, because I think Arsene Wenger, more than anyone, is aware of the threat that Liverpool poses. So I think that we should be a little more wary of that. What do you think, Johnny?
Yeah, I don't think we can play an open game against them. Their firepower, especially their speed on the break, is frightening. They're pre-scoring. They're not very good at the back, but if we play an open game, it becomes a game of who can score more. And just even looking at basics this season, I think Salah's got as many league goals as Alexis Lacazette, and I know he's not going to be playing, but Giroud combined. So you can't. So that's just one player that's taken out, well, you'd imagine, two of our starters. So you can't fight fire with fire on that respect. Then you've got, if you look deeper than that, Ozil's got, what, two or three goals this year. They're outscoring us. You don't need to go into who scored what. They're outscoring us. So I think it'd be stupid to fight fire with fire. I would personally, in terms of, I think there's an in-between, as Schwinn said, between parking the bus and going flat out. Something like what we did against Tottenham, where we was aggressive, but we didn't overcommit. And then once we felt the game was won at 2-0, we basically played on the counter. We left the quicker players up sort of on the halfway line to occupy their defenders. And I'm not ashamed to say it, we pretty much went long ball, but it wasn't long aimless. I would say more long passes of getting it in behind and getting the runners to stretch the pitch. And I think obviously that does depend on you getting a lead, but even at 0-0, the way we played against Tottenham was it wasn't open, but it definitely wasn't part of the pass. It was aggressive pressing, but without overcommitting.
If we go back four, what role does Xhaka play? Does he play more of an attacking or more of a defensive?
No, I think in a back four, it's probably more vital that he sits deep, especially if he's going to have Jack alongside him, because there's no point having Jack sitting deep. It's a waste of him. Look, he can pass the ball, he'll complete passes at 10 yards, but there's many players that can do that. You're wasting the ability that Jack has if you tell him to sit very deep. In an ideal world with a 4-2-3-1, you want someone defensive and then someone who's capable in defensive areas but can also play a bit to play 10 yards ahead of them. I mean, in an Arsenal circumstance, the ideal one that's actually worked best for us over the last few years was Coquelin and Cazorla. And you had Coquelin as the defensive midfielder and Cazorla who was helping out. He was another body defensively, but he played maybe 10 yards ahead of Coquelin, and he was the distributor or the deep line playmaker, as the modern phrase of football wants to call it.
Yep.
So I think you'd have Xhaka in an ideal, I don't know whether he's up to the job, but if them two do start in front of a back four, you'd have Xhaka deeper and Jack ever so slightly further forward. And as we spoke about last week, the rotation between Jack and Xhaka, Jack and Mesut, it's easier to do if Jack isn't too deep.
Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to work out where our firepower comes from, because we haven't been, like you said, they've outscored us. Look, I'm not even going to go into the stats on, but anyone can tell that their firepower is, pretty wild. So where's our attack come from? Obviously, through Jack, Ozil, Sanchez, Lacazette, but they haven't been doing it each week, have they?
Well, I mean, look, it's difficult because we've played against teams that pretty much, again, I don't want to say part of the bus because it's become a derogatory term, but a team that have defended deep and well in the last West Ham, Southampton, Newcastle, and then before that, Man United, when we only scored one goal, but attacking-wise, we was impressive. We carved them apart at times. Look, I know the only stat that really counts is putting the ball in the net, but you can't say that was a poor attacking performance. The finishing may have been a bit off, and their keeper had one of the best games I've seen from a keeper, but you can't say we lacked firepower in that game. So this game will be a bit more open, you'd imagine. And if given the chance, obviously it depends what Alexis turns up, it depends what Mesut turns up, but between them two and Jack, there's more than enough ability to create there. And you obviously you're basing this conversation on the back four because you asked about how does Xhaka sit in front of defenders.
There would also be
an extra body over on the right. So whether that be Welbeck or Iwobi or Walcott, whoever it may be, it won't be Walcott. But you then also got an extra body in there to add to that. So you're looking at, you say, where does the firepower come from? And if you're looking at Lacazette, Alexis, Ozil, Jack, and one other, said Welbeck or Iwobi, there's not many teams that would turn that down if you said, here's the firepower you've got today. And believe me, every team in the league will think, okay, we've got an issue here. It's not, you don't look at them and think, easy day's work for our defenders. Even the best defence in the world would think, we've got a game today. If you look at them players coming at you.
Okay. No, I'm just looking at, like, you know, we had a brilliant game against the Spurs. We beat them up at 2-0. And then since then, you know, we come with some, how many chances against Manchester United? You know, it's few and far between. But if teams, I suppose, like you say, they're parking the bus.
Yeah, I mean, look, the counter argument to that is 3 days before Man United, we played Huddersfield, and people might go, it's only Huddersfield. But United scored one against them and lost. City scored two against them and won. We scored five. I don't think anyone else has five past them this season. I know Tottenham scored four, but we played them at home, and it does make things completely different. I think Liverpool beat them 4-0 at home, and we beat them 5-0 at home. So we can score goals. I don't think, as an Arsenal fan, it's been a long time since my worry about the club is, can we score goals?
Okay. Righto. Schwinn, you got any on that, mate, or we move on?
Yeah, the only thing I'll add is that in terms of our firepower, I think we must remember that although both defenses are pretty questionable, I think there's no doubt that we have a better defense than Liverpool. So, it's a matter of balance, and they do have more firepower, but I think they have a more single-dimensional firepower. I'm not trying to take anything away from them, but I think they rely quite a lot on their pace and on mistakes from the opposition. And we are a little different in that regard. We try to break down defenses, and we try to, you know, have those interplays that close to the box that let people through. So I think our firepower might not resemble theirs in terms of strength, but then again, we have to deal with less robust defense when it comes to Liverpool. So I think if we take our chances well, then we have a very good chance of winning this game. A lot of people are questioning if we can do it against a flying Liverpool side. And I think it will be a challenge, but I think there's a lot in the game for us to exploit. Liverpool is by no means a concrete and solidified team. There's a lot of holes in their game. And I'm sure Liverpool fans would agree with me when I say this. I'm not trying to be an arsehole here. I'm just trying to be objective. Those holes are in our team as well, but I think Liverpool has more holes in their defensive unit than Arsenal. So if we are able to win that battle in midfield, and if our midfielders are able to create and press, then we could have a really good game at the Emirates today.
Yeah, well, I hope you're right, Schwinn. So, because I've got a 3-2 prediction, mate, I'm going to throw $100 on it. Okay, Tony, I just want to talk about Wenger's tactics, mate. Like, what's your thoughts on the formation changes each week, the team changes each week? Is it confusing the players, or is it confusing the opposition?
No. Just because we're not aware of what's going on doesn't mean they're going to. They don't know. They will train specifically for each game and with each game in mind. It's why he likes to use a different team for the League Cup or the Carabao Cup and the Europa League. And in a way, I think it's an advantage for us as fans not to know, because it means the opposition probably don't know, which makes it harder for them to prepare and plan for us. As I said, it's not like he walks in on the day and says to the players, 10 minutes before kickoff, we're playing five at the back today. They'll be fully aware and they'll know what they're doing. So, otherwise, if that wasn't the case, then he wouldn't have bothered with the whole Lacazette isn't going to play against United and then dropping him in. Because obviously he was saying that, so he was hoping United would prepare for Giroud. and then Lacazette is a different proposition. So yeah, just because we don't know doesn't mean it's necessarily a bad thing. As I said, it's not. The players will know, which is what matters.
These lower teams, they seem to be just setting up defence. Is that because they don't know?
I think they would do that regardless. It doesn't matter. Don't know what we're going to put out, but they know we're going to be. We need the win, and they would be happy with a point. Mm. It's a bit easier for the lower teams coming away in terms of how they're going to set up, because they know what they're going to do. Their aim is, in all honesty, most teams come to the Emirates looking for a point. So they couldn't care less if we played 10 up front or none up front. They want that point. Mm. And I think the change to the back four has come in teams where we knew they were going to defend deep. So it's only been two league games, which are West Ham away and Newcastle at home, both of whom defended deep. And he's changed to a four at the back to try and push an extra body into midfield to give us more, again, to sort of bring up the term, attacking firepower. I don't see it as a negative. I don't see it as a constant change. He's changed in the games where we needed to try and score more, essentially. I think it poses more... What formation we'll play poses more of a problem for a Liverpool than it does for a Newcastle, who probably couldn't care less what we're going to do.
You'd much prefer him... you're happy like knowing that not what he's going to do, I suppose. You like that...
Happy. I'm happy not knowing, because for years we had the... Look, the first time people started questioning Wenger and saying he doesn't do tactics was when they were saying, oh, we know we can name the team every week, we can name the formation. Mm. And then now when we can't name the team and formation, maybe we can name the team, we can't name the formation, people are going, oh, he's clueless, he doesn't know what he's doing. Again, it stinks of moaning at both examples. Because, look, if we played 4-2-3-1 every week, as we had done for probably the last 4 years, people would go, oh, it's always the same. He never changes it up. It's very easy for opposition managers because they know exactly what we're going to do. Mm-hmm. Now he's changed it up. People are going, oh, he doesn't know what he's doing, blah, blah, blah. How can he win? What's the answer?
Yeah, I know. Damn you do, damn you don't, aren't you? Yeah. Back to the fans. Tactics for today, what do you think you'll come in
with? We had probably quite a heated debate on here a few weeks ago about having slow starts or fast starts or whatnot. And I mentioned this then. We absolutely have to still be in this game after 15 minutes. And that may sound stupid, but Liverpool are notoriously fast starters. They're known for it. More so at Anfield, but just in general, they start the game quickly. They come out and go for the throw. Too often, Arsenal have succumbed to that and been 1-0, 2-0 down after 15 minutes, and the game's gone. Or you're chasing the game, similar to United, you're chasing the game and you leave holes. If you're 2-0 down after 15 minutes against one of these top teams, it don't matter how much better than them you are, you ain't going to win. You may get a draw if you're lucky, but you probably won't. So for me, I mentioned the Tottenham game earlier, I think we should be compact for 10, 15 minutes. Let Liverpool not give them the ball and not park the bus, but not just go completely open and give them the space they need. Space is one of the hardest things to earn in football, and we tend to give it away. But as I said, against Liverpool, I don't think you can do that. So for me, I'd be happy with a 15, 20 minutes of just nothing happening, really. Just one of them games you go, oh, the ball's been ratted around in the middle, but nothing's really happened.
Yep.
For me, I'd be happy with that after 15, 20 minutes. And this is what obviously the debate was having a few weeks ago when people were going, oh, it's not a fast start. But for me today, that would be, maybe it's not a fast start, but it would be an ideal start. Because this is a game you could lose in the first 15 minutes. But beyond that, keep it tight for 15, 20. You need to be aggressive. People are always going to shout for a high press. I think it'd be suicidal to do that today. Because when you high press, the strikers obviously push onto their centre-backs, which means your midfield need to go 20 yards forward, which means your defence need to go 20 yards forward. We cannot allow them space in behind. Their main thing, and as Schwinn said earlier, their attack is very good and very potent, but not really varied. So if you're given, they are very quick, and you'd say they're probably not the best in the air. So ideally, you would want to defend deeps, because if they're not likely to beat you in the air, but likely to run in behind you, you want to limit the space in behind you. I mean, it's not as simple as that, because they've got players like Coutinho that can hit the ball from 30-odd yards. But for me, it would be a press, but not a high energy press all over the place. the difficulty comes is because their centre-backs aren't the best on the ball. You want to press them, but then as I said, the problem comes, you have to press as a team, because if you press as a two, just your two attackers, it's never going to work. Yep. It'll be three defenders and it's easy to, and a keeper. So it's 4v2 and it's very easy to get out of that situation. So tactically, it is a tough one, but I would prefer us to sit. No, I'm not saying stupid deep, but I don't want any space in behind, because that's when Mane, Salah, and to an extent Firmino come into their own.
Okay, first 15 minutes, you said, are the crucial 15 minutes. Touch wood, this doesn't happen. We go down 1-0 in the 10th minute. What does he change anything, or he just plays smart football to get it back?
Well, yeah, the problem with us, and it's been a long, long-standing problem for as long as I can remember, is we go 1-0 down and we think, shit, we have to make it 1-0 right now.
Yeah.
And then we bomb forward and leave holes, and then more likely than not, especially against the better teams, we go 2 and 3-0 down. For me, if we go 1-0 down after 10 minutes, nothing should change.
Yep.
There's still 80 minutes. There's still, whatever, what is that, 75% of the game left. If, I mean, if you had stoppage time, it's nearly 80% of the game left.
Mm.
So for me, nothing should change, but that's not what Arsenal do. If you've got 80 minutes plus stoppage time in both halves to equalise, you don't have to do it in the next 2 minutes. So for me, nothing should change. And I would like, as I said, in the first 10, 15, 20 minutes, I'd like our full-backs or wing-backs, whatever they may be, to sit next to our centre-backs and not be 20, 30, 40 yards ahead of them as so often they are. Just keep it tight for that 15, 20, regardless if we go 1-0 down. Don't break mould too easy, because then, as I said, you can... A football match you can lose in the first 20 minutes.
Mm.
But by
well,
being
1-0... against Manchester United, didn't we? That's what exactly what we did.
But if we go 1-0 down after 10 minutes, and then we go all out to make it 1-0, and we do, it's still only 1-0. We've still not won that game. So you can lose it in the first 20 minutes, but from that 1-0 down position, you're not going to win it in the first 20 minutes. And I think you've got to look at it like that, the risk versus reward. You're risking losing a game with no real reward. Yeah, you're back level in that game, but you're only level... But, so the risk is no points, and the reward is 1-1 after 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's just it's maintaining the risk versus reward, just sitting in the game. Obviously, if you go...
Yeah, sorry, that was my phone.
Obviously, yeah, if you go 2 and 3-0 down, things may change. But at 1-0, for me, I don't think you should start going out and trying to equalise with the next kick.
Okay. Now, you did talk about, and I'll get you in a minute, Schwinn, on some tactics and your thoughts, but I just want to see, Tony Chambers, you said, had a good game. Does he get a start on the bench today?
I would imagine he'll be on the bench. We've not really had a centre-back on the bench the last few weeks. It'll be interesting to see what they do with Mertesacker. I was quite surprised he wasn't involved the other day in the Carabao Cup, because he's not been... He played at Southampton, and he's not been involved since. So I was quite surprised that he wasn't... whether he's carrying a knock or whatever. Yeah. But for me, yeah, again, it depends on the shape, because if we go four at the back, I know Schwinn said earlier that he would expect Nacho to drop out and Mustafi and Koscielny play together. I can't see that happening at all. I think if we do go four at the back, it'll be Nacho and Koscielny, and then Mustafi will probably be the one centre-back on the bench. You don't need to, especially at four. So it all depends on the shape, but has he earned a place on the bench? Yeah, definitely, but it all depends on how many centre-backs are already on the pitch.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Schwinn, what's your take on tactics, mate?
I really don't know what to expect, to be honest. As Tony said, that this uncertainty is good, because if fans don't know what to expect, maybe the opposition doesn't know what to expect. So it's all thinking out loud here, and I could be way off when I say what I'm about to say. But I think it's going to be a game that we try to suffocate. I think we're going to, again, I'm not trying to say that we're going to park the bus. That's not going to be our intention. But I think we're going to place a smart defense. I think you can expect the attackers, other than Lacazette and maybe Alexis, to stay up top. We can expect everyone else to sort of drop into midfield. Mesut Ozil and Jack Wilshere in particular, to give Granit Xhaka that support, when we're in our own half defending. So again, I'm going to come back to my point of the midfield. I think both offenses and defenses have their you know, there's enough been said about both offenses and defenses, but I think the game is going to be won in midfield. And I think we have the quality to run them in midfield. I mean, looking at the Liverpool side, I would expect Henderson, Chan maybe, although he hasn't featured in a bit because of some contract negotiations. So maybe not Chan, but maybe Wijnaldum and Coutinho, because I think Adam Lallana is also still recovering. He's not fully fit to start. If he was, I would expect him to start. But I think it's going to be Coutinho, Wijnaldum, and Henderson. If you compare those three with Granit Xhaka, Jack Wilshere, and Mesut Ozil, I think we have better quality. We have more composure. And while the Liverpool players are usually looking for a forward pass, I think we are a little more calculated in that regard. So if we can suffocate them in midfield, and I think that is what Wenger is going to try and do, I think we can dominate the game because they'll have to rely on long balls, and that will lead to a little bit of isolation. They have the pace, but then again, if we play five defenders in the back, then we outnumber them on each flank and in the middle of the park. We could have two players guarding, you know, one of their attackers almost. So I expect our wing backs to not go super high. I would expect them to maintain modest positions, be a player on the ball when available, when someone needs support. I expect them to be super wide to stretch the field, and Mesut Ozil and Alexis Sanchez to drop in the hole and try to create. I don't think there's going to be too much interplay. I think we're going to, as Tony said about Liverpool, I think we're going to go for the throat as well, because I don't think we're going to try and rely on creating too many chances, but I definitely think that we're going to try and be very clinical with the few chances that we want to create. So I would go for a very anti-Arsenal performance in that regard, which is what exactly I think we need against an attacking force like Liverpool.
Mm-hmm. Tony, mate, I agree a little bit what is that say, Schwinn, but I'm just thinking Welbeck, if he starts, Iwobi goes on the bench, and then, well, Lacazette, has he got 90 minutes in him?
I think he does.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Sorry, go for it, Tony.
Oh, it's a different one. It remains to be seen, but look, between the two of them, one of the two will have 90 in them. So even if Lacazette doesn't and gets subbed after 70 to rapturous boos, as seems to happen every week, regardless of how Lacazette's playing, Welbeck switches to up top and Iwobi comes in his position. I think you've got a trust between the two of them, or even there's potential to put Sanchez up there. And then if we've got someone that can play wide, you can move Jack forward. There's options. But does Lacazette have 90 in him? He appears to. He's played 90 a few times, and recently when he's come off, look, I was the first to say, and from what I saw at games, that he came off due to fitness a lot in the first maybe month, 2 months he was here. But recently when he's came off, it was just because he wasn't good enough or on the day, or was completely ineffective. Again, that's a bit harsh saying not good enough, but some days you're just ineffective. It happens. So Southampton were defending deep. We couldn't get any space in behind. We weren't getting any half chances for him to feed on. So we bring on a tall guy who could challenge their defenders in them deep positions. That's not so much a criticism against Lacazette. He's 5'7". You know what he's able to do and what he isn't. But he didn't come off that day due to fitness is the point I'm trying to get at. Mm. Against Newcastle the other day, he didn't come off due to fitness. He came off because he wasn't playing very well. So can he do 90? In truth, it remains to be seen, but the signs are good, because it's not like the early weeks in the season when he was coming off because he was blown out of his arse. He's come off because he's been not involved in the game in the level that we would like him to be, and probably he would like himself to be.
Mm, okay. And our midfield, we haven't got much depth there at the moment, have we? We've got Santi out, Ramsey's out, so Jack will start. Coughlin, he might get a bench spot maybe.
Well, Xhaka, he came off injured the other day. I don't know. I'm not sure how bad the injury is, but I doubt he'd be involved today.
Okay.
I think he trained with the team. Yesterday's training session pictures showed Coughlin be a part of it. So maybe he will find his way onto the bench, unless Wenger thinks that there's still a niggle. But yeah, that's a question mark for sure.
Okay. Right, Tony, you wanted to also talk a little bit about Sanchez and to Manchester City.
Oh, here it comes. Yeah. I'm curious to learn about what Tony has for us here.
Yeah, so obviously for a long time now, we've all thought that Sanchez would find his way to Man City, and that still could be the case. But There's been a few hiccups. Well, again, these the rumoured hiccups. Obviously, for regular listeners, you know, I used to work very closely with an agent, with a few agents, and sometimes what they say is true, sometimes what they say is for their own benefit, as you can imagine. Just speaking to someone the other day, and they said there's Man City are not showing anywhere near the interest that they were in the summer. Basically, obviously, we all know Guardiola had issues with Sanchez's attitude when they were at Barcelona. He felt Sanchez played for himself and was a bit stroppy, which we've seen. Even when he was good for us, we've seen that he played for himself and he was stroppy. And so Guardiola obviously saw what Sanchez played very well last year and he had a very good returns in terms of goals and assists. So Guardiola saw that and saw that the ability is obviously still there, if not heightened from what he saw at Barcelona. And also, I think it's more so directly in games against Man City or in major games in general. If you look last season, like Sanchez against Man City, he performed in the semi-final. He was very good in the semi-final against them. In the home game against them, we was on the back of a bit of a losing streak. And in all fairness to Sanchez, it was him that kind of pulled us together. I can't remember if it was Walcott's goal or Mustafi's goal in that game to equalise. They both scored equalisers, one to make it 1-1, one to make it 2-2. But no one went to celebrate with the goal scorer. And it was Sanchez that was pulling everyone over and saying, come on, like, we're a team. We win together, we lose together. And that impressed Guardiola because he thought, oh, maybe he's got rid of a bit of the selfishness and the Sanchez is the only person that matters attitude. And then also in the FA Cup, which is obviously another big game, that again, Sanchez was a real team player and had a very good game again. So I think Guardiola, the reason he went after him was obviously like his ability as a player was never questioned, but it was his attitude. And from them games, and especially the fixtures against City, Guardiola thought, well, he's matured, he's grown up, he's 3-4 years older, he's a different man now. This season, Sanchez has gone back to absolutely everything that Guardiola didn't like about him when he was at Barcelona. From what I've heard, this has led to questions about whether Guardiola wants him in the squad.
Just out of curiosity, where does he fit into City?
I mean, look, the attacking left midfield position, or like left wing, whatever you want to call it, left forward, there's not many better. For me, he is still better than Leroy Sané. Like, Sané's younger and Sané's a very good player. I'm not belittling Leroy Sané. But for me, an unsung Alexis and a happy Alexis is a better player. I don't think Sané would ever get the returns that Sanchez gets. And bear in mind, you would argue that he's playing in a better team now than Sanchez has probably ever played, or definitely has ever played in an Arsenal shirt. And Sané still won't get the numbers that Sanchez got in terms of goals, assists, man of the matches even. Also, then you look at, I mean, Guardiola rotates quite a lot because they're firing strong in four competitions. I mean, the FA Cup ain't started yet, but they're going to fire strong in four competitions. So then you look at, is he better than Bernardo Silva? Yes. Is he better than whoever replaces Raheem? Is he better than Raheem Sterling? Probably, but at the moment it's difficult to say because Sterling's had a great season so far. But is he better than whoever replaces Raheem Sterling when Raheem Sterling's out? Yes. So does he fit in? Yeah, for me, look, he's having a bad time of things at the moment and it's probably self-inflicted. But when people go, oh, I can't see where he'd get in, I don't buy that for a second. The issue Guardiola's having is, do they really want to pay money for a guy that is absolutely everything that Guardiola didn't like about him a few years ago? For me, that leads to, will they go for him in January? Probably not. Would they still take him free in the summer? Probably. Just from what I've heard, and again, it's come from an agent. That doesn't mean it's concrete. And I'm not trying to be in the know, because an in the know would say, fact, this is going to happen. I don't know what's going to happen. But indications lead to City probably not coming in for him in January.
Okay, and you mentioned a couple of in the knows, and I don't know what truth is in it, but I did read a couple of tweets earlier in the week, PSG.
I mean, look, that would be ideal for Arsenal because, well, it depends. If it was to be January, it'd be better than Man City in either way, but if it was January, it'd be ideal for us because we'd get a fee for him. If it was the summer, it would still be better than him going to Man City in the summer because they're not a direct rival. And look, people are pretending he's now an awful player and they don't rate him. If you don't rate him, you want him to go to Man City. I want them to have worse players. So if people are telling me he's shit and he wouldn't get in the Man City team, okay, let him go there. But you're kidding yourself, because he's not shit. And he's a very dangerous player. He's a match winner, as we all know. Is he as frustrating as hell? Yes. Is he a match winner? Also, yes.
He'd be looking at PSG, though, and going, well, I'm competing with Neymar. I've got no chance of starting, have I?
It depends, because, I mean, look, there's issues with Neymar at PSG as it is, but they can attack as much as they like. They don't have to conform to normal rules because of how strong they are compared to the rest of their league.
Yeah.
So, look, you'd say for now they'll play Mbappe on the right, Neymar on the left, and Cavani in the middle. But then their 10 position is always up for grabs.
Mm.
And as I mentioned last week on the pod, teams love players that are interchangeable. So if Neymar drops into that 10, as he likes to do, then Sanchez could push out left, and you're not making yourself any weaker.
Yep.
Or if Cavani drops deep to come and get the ball, then Sanchez goes in behind, or Mbappe goes in behind, Sanchez goes right. They're all completely interchangeable, which is what teams like. So he could fit in there. They would pay a truckload of money, you'd imagine. If he does go there, I'd say there's more chance of January than the summer, because look, they're going to win their league. You'd imagine they're looking at him with the sole focus of Champions League, especially now they've drawn Real Madrid, which is a hell of a tie, by the way. So, look, that would be the best possible move for Arsenal. I don't know if it's going to happen. As I said, I spoke to the agent about the issues that Man City are currently having. But what's going to happen with him beyond that, I ain't got a clue. As I said, I don't even know if the Man City stuff is 100%. As in, it's what the agents told me, but Man City could still go for him in January. But from the talk in football, and the agents talk to each other, and maybe the inside of dealings, they don't know, but the general feeling, the general things that are being spoke about in football, they'll all know.
Mm-hmm.
And the general feeling in football is that Man City won't come back in for him in January.
Can I jump in here real quick?
I was just about to ask you, mate. Yep, shoot.
Yeah, so I have a question, and I don't know how factual this is, so I just started a tweet. I don't even remember if it was from a verified account or not. But whoever it was claimed that PSG have a lot of problems with financial fair play right now, and if they need to bring in talent, especially if it will be someone like Alexis, who will be on a pretty high salary, they might have to get rid of players like Lucas Moura, Javier Pastore, Julian Draxler. So I can see how PSG would be, a good destination in terms of the concept of Alexis moving there. But won't such a situation create a lot of factors that will need to happen in order for Alexis to PSG to happen?
I see where you're going with it, but everyone said that about Neymar. And then after Neymar, everyone said that about Mbappe. And so on and so forth. They didn't actually sell anyone. After they signed Mbappe, they didn't sell anyone. They let Jakovic go on loan. They let Hesse go on loan. There's a guy who's on loan at Valencia. I can't remember his name, who's touted at a sort of 30 million rated player.
Gonzalo Guedes, I think.
Yeah, that's the one. I knew his name. I just didn't know how to say it, and I didn't want to make an arse of myself.
I might have done, because I don't know either.
Yeah, I'll let you take up that role. So they seem to not care. And if you look, I know Man City did, and there was another team, I can't remember who it was, a few years ago, fell foul of financial fair play. And the punishment was a fine. Well, they live in a bottomless pit of money. And it wasn't a big fine in comparison. I mean, I wouldn't want to pay it, but in comparison, it wasn't a big fine. And their Champions League squad got reduced from 25 to 22. Neither of them things will bother PSG. So, I mean, more of a question is, do they really care? Look, they would like to fit in with the rules because it was rumoured a few years ago that when they were looking for a manager, they didn't want Mourinho because of the image he brought to them, because they're trying to come in as a sports superpower, but they're also trying to be likable. So they're trying to put on an entertaining team with the world's best players, and look, they're throwing unlimited money at it. But they're trying to come across as good guys, so to speak, and that's why they didn't want Mourinho. So they would like to be in line with financial fair play, but they would prefer to be adored by football fans, because as football fans, we don't particularly care about financial fair play. We want to see good teams play football. So they'd be pleasing more people by getting a Sanchez than they would by pissing people off with financial fair play. Unless the punishments with FFP get bigger, stricter, harsher, then I can't see them overly giving a fuck. As I said, I think they'll try and fall in line with it. And I read a tweet the other day, actually, from I think it was a Sky account, or saying they're having meetings with UEFA to see how they can fall in line. But again, I think they'd like to do it. I don't think they're overly concerned if they don't fall in line with it. Because if someone's going to say to them, okay, it's a 10 million fine and you have to drop three players from your Champions League squad, that's not going to bother them.
I had a tweet from a guy today, Tony, and I'm just trying to find the tweet while you're talking, but you might be able to answer it while I try and find his name. We play Crystal Palace twice in about 6 weeks, I think it was. So the 20... Yeah, here it is. So Gunnar Gabod, he said, look, after the Liverpool game, then on the 28th of December, we have Crystal Palace. Then again, on the 20th of January, we play Crystal Palace again. Is this allowed? Obviously, it is allowed, but...
I think the point he was trying to get at is we're going to be playing Liverpool twice before we played Palace once, because obviously we played Liverpool in the third game of the season. But it's like that for everyone. So Tottenham that day, obviously I was coming back from Anfield, Tottenham played Burnley at Wembley and they drew 1-1, and this weekend they're playing Burnley at Turf Moor. And whoever anyone played on that weekend, they're playing again this weekend, obviously in the reverse fixture. It used to always be the case that you'd play in the first 18 games, you'd play one team twice and one team not at all. I don't know why that is, but it just the supercomputer random generator, whatever one you call it, always used to be like that. I think it was either last year or 2 years ago was the first time in years that the 18 teams played each other in 18 and then another 18. So your first 18 games or 19 games, sorry, were against the other clubs. So it's not unusual. It's more the rule than the exception. But as I said, last year or the year before, there was a change to that. But yeah, it happens. It happens very regularly. I think if you look at the fixtures from years gone by, you tend to play a team twice before you play at least one team once.
Okay, right on. Okay, before we get into some questions from our listeners, you can follow at Football Culture, who you see. Glenn tweeted today, he won his prize, his Lacazette jersey. We got that from Football Culture, and you can find them at football-culture.com, and you can use the Football Culture sale to get 10% off. Okay, so Schwinn, talking about Glenn, we got one straight from him, who's a regular listener and a regular question man, which we like, so keep them coming. Do you think we have what it takes to beat Chelsea over two legs to make Wembley?
We do. I think Chelsea is in a rut. Having said that, I don't know what sort of a team we're going to put out there. I mean, in all probability, it is going to be our second team, and then it all boils down to who Chelsea plays. I have not watched any of their Carabao Cup games, so I'm not entirely certain, but I would imagine they've been playing their second team squad as well. So I think it's well balanced, but Chelsea's second squad is not necessarily their second squad. It's maybe their third squad, because they have a lot of players out on loan, as is always the case. So I think we are stronger than them in that regard, and over two legs, I think we would have a better chance of going through to the next round.
Okay. Tony by Chris Nielsen. Question. Xhaka has had more low moments than high moments since his arrival. Should we replace him or buy someone to accomplish him so we can get the best out of him, or is he just not suited for the EPL?
Look, I think I read this question. This came in a few days ago, and it's a good question, to be fair. I think the problem with his position, just in general, not him, this is taking Granit Xhaka out of it, his position is their higher moments aren't noticed. So he was excellent in the FA Cup final against Chelsea in the Community Shield. It's a glorified friendly, but he was unbelievable. He played the role absolutely perfectly. I think he did get man of the match in the end. But in a perfect game, he didn't get a goal or an assist. He didn't make a match-saving tackle, so nothing he done will be remembered. So when you're going high moments versus low moments, people probably think, oh, I remember he scored a banger against Hull away. He scored a banger against Notts Forest away in the Cup last year. He scored against Man United at home. It's deflected. He scored against Ludogorets away. They're probably thinking of them as high moments, and the low moments are all times when he's given the ball away and it's led to a goal or given away a penalty and whatnot. So I just think it's in general, in that position, that your high moments aren't really noticed because they're nothing special. Like, many people will tell you that Makalele was the best defensive midfielder probably ever. Or say, let's go Gilberto Silva to keep it Arsenal central. That he was the best actual pure defensive midfielder we've had. Like, Vieira used to bomb forward and he had the pace and the power. But Gilberto sat in front there and obviously was known as the invisible wall. Name a specific high moment of something he'd done. And not many people can. They've seen him play and they know he was brilliant. And I'm not denying that. He was unbelievable. But what were his highs? You go to a game, I can't think of a specific, but you go, we kept a clean sheet in this game because he made a few, like, he broke the play up really well. That's not a highlight. Mm. And that's not to say it isn't good and it isn't needed, but it's not a highlight. Whereas the lows, when you give the ball away and you concede, that's easily rememberable. You go, he made that mistake. A mistake's easy to remember, but in that position, it's the highs aren't highlights. They're still highs. You've still done very well, but they're not highlights. In the same sense, we had this debate a few weeks ago when we were talking about Jack signing a new contract. Because you could say similar to Jack. Maybe he doesn't have the lows, but you could say, what are his highs? And I brought up the Barcelona game where he was unbelievable. He didn't actually, in terms of what you remember in terms of highlights, he passed the ball a bit.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Has Xhaka been perfect? No. Does he have the attributes to be very good? I believe so. The second part of the question, do we buy someone to accompany him in the middle?
Yeah.
I can't see the type of player that would. Because if you get a raw defensive midfielder, a pure defensive midfielder, alongside him, then you lose the attacking intent that either a Jack or a Ramsey give you. If you buy who you would put next to him to bring out his strengths more. I just think, for me, he needs to be more consistent. And as I touched on last week, that he has the strengths as a defensive midfielder and he has the strengths of a deep-line playmaker. He just needs to marry them both together and be consistent with it. I believe there's a very good player in there. Have we seen the best of him? Not consistently enough. As I said, there's been games where he's been unbelievable, but they're not games you really remember. So I don't think the lows outweigh the highs. I just think the lows are rememberable.
Okay. EPL suits him?
You usually say the problems with the Premier League are the fast pace and how rushed you are. And when I mean fast pace, I mean the getting up and down. You have to, but in his position, that's not really such a factor. So I think defensive midfielder is one of the positions is probably a bit easier for a transition, because a good defensive midfielder doesn't get too far ahead of the ball. They only really cover sort of 30-40% of the pitch, so it's not like they have to get up and down as quick. I wouldn't say he's not suited to the Premier League.
I'm just wondering whether Chris is actually implying maybe we loan him out for a season, let him get them the high moments, what he's talking about, and then bring him back and he's type of ready.
I don't think the high moments in his position, they're never going to get noticed. So even if he's having them, they're not going to get noted. Like we all said last week, he was excellent for the first 70 minutes against Newcastle, and we all unanimously agreed about that.
Mm.
Give me a high moment. I mean, and I'm talking last week, so you should be able to remember it. It wasn't, do you know what I mean? Even though we all agreed that he was excellent for 70 and he kind of messed it up with the last 20, but we can't remember anything that he'd done that made him excellent. He just was.
Standouts, he didn't score or assist.
Yeah, and I think that's more a problem with the position. It's not a problem, it's a factor of the position. Mm. But I don't think loaning him out would do him any favours. And again, if you're saying it's the Premier League he's not ready for, you're not going to loan him to another Premier League side, and he's not going to get the experience of playing in the Premier League if he's in La Liga or the Bundesliga or Ligue 1 or whatever.
Yeah.
So for me, it's just about him and how it gets there, whether it's 3 minutes or whatever it is. Just about making him consistent and being able to do both jobs. But consistently, he tends to be doing one at a time at the moment, which is quite frustrating when you know and you've seen examples of him doing both.
Okay, Schwinn.
I just want to butt in there and say I think by the time this season ends, we're going to have so many Granit Xhaka questions that I'm going to pull my fucking hair out.
He comes up every week, doesn't he?
And it's so harsh on the lad because, I mean, selling him, I'm sorry, whoever sent the question, I'm not trying to be an asshole here, but selling him, I mean, that's not us, you know? We don't have the financial capacity to do that, and I'm glad we don't because what would we be then, you know? What's our ethos then?
We're not a Manchester City.
Yeah, I don't want that, you know? I want us to compete with the best teams, needless to say, but we have traditions, we have honor, a victory through harmony, you know? That's what we believe in, and I'm sorry, we cannot do that. You know, we just bought in this lad. Give him some time. He, as Tony said, he has all the attributes. He doesn't have the pace, but if he can build in that positioning. Michael Carrick never had that pace, but he was always 5 seconds ahead of every play. Mm. If Granit Xhaka can do that, which will only come with time, again, back to Tony's point about what he was talking about, you know, about Lacazette, once he understands the teams, Lacazette only has to understand defenders, you know, but Granit Xhaka has to understand the whole opposition. He has to place himself based on the opposition. And that will only come with time. He has the passing range. He does not mind going into a challenge. He's vocal on the field. He's a little tall. He can provide a challenge in the air. He might not win headers, but he can be a body in there. Tony's absolutely right. Who do we bring in? You know, a pure one won't do the trick in terms of attacking. And not many attacking footballers can be that good defensively midfield. So yeah, I'm just rambling on, but just give the lad some time. He will come through.
You've actually made a very good point there that Xhaka always gets compared to your Kantes and your pure defensive midfielders, as I call them, your Wanyamas and your, there's not too many more in the Premier League, but Carrick is a much better comparison because they both can play the ball as well. Whereas Kante, don't get me wrong, is a very good player, but he gets the ball and gives it 5-10 yards to a Fabregas or a Drinkwater or someone there who's quite good with long-range passing or just passing in general. Whereas Carrick is a perfect example. It's someone that you try and get to do both roles. And I've never really heard anyone say it before, but Carrick is probably the best comparison I've heard.
Okay, we'll stick with you, Schwinn. Joe Hurd. And we've got a heap of questions to get through, boys, I just realised. So Dennis has been sacked from AX as number two there. Surely it's time we brought him back to the club. Very important to have former players in and around the club.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with the last statement. It is very important to have your own players around the club and someone like Dennis Bergkamp who can educate you know, the talent coming through. I tweeted out yesterday that bring this man back home, when I saw the news. But maybe I perhaps got a little carried away because we have to try and see why he was fired. I don't know nearly enough about Ajax to come to a decision and form my own opinion. I'm still trying to get the facts and still trying to read up on what's made available to us. There's no denying that Dennis Bergkamp is one of the best players to ever wear the Arsenal shirt. But let's not forget that Marco Overmars is the one who fired him. Now, what's been cited so far has been that there has been differences in how to bring about technical changes into the play of the team. So, I think there's still information coming out, and I would be wrong to suggest one way or the other from what little I know. Maybe Tony can touch upon this a little more. But we have to see that Dennis Bergkamp might not be the best person to bring in either because, you know, A, the man doesn't fly. So if you are bringing him in some sort of capacity, it would be to interact with the players, and for that you need to fly. And B, that there has been a lot of movement around the club. I think we just signed someone from Reading to take up a role in our youth academy. So there are a lot of changes happening already. We only get to hear about them once they're announced or once, you know, they're almost finished. So maybe we've signed someone or maybe we're in talks with someone already who is going to take up that role that Dennis would occupy. So I don't know what to really make of it. I love Dennis Bergkamp. I don't think there's anyone who listens to this pod or who has ever watched Arsenal either who would disagree. He has the touch of a magician, and he can do whatever he wants with the ball. But there's a lot more that needs to be considered when you're trying to bring in someone for a more enhanced role. So maybe Tony can touch upon this a little bit more.
Yeah, just I mean, you kind of stole my thunder with one of your lines there. But the first thing I would say is doing what role is just a question I'd pose back. Again, a lot of people want a romantic view of bringing what clearly is a legend who's got a statue outside the ground back to the club. But doing what? You can't just bring people back because they were a good, even great player for the club. You can't. Otherwise, we'd have so many players at the club doing absolute doing absolutely nothing, because there'd be loads of them. So the first question I would say is exactly doing what. He was an assistant there, due to, as Swin, where he stole my thunder, due to not flying, he can never be an assistant here. We're going to be involved in Europe every year in some form. You need your assistant to travel. Where you're playing every 2 to 3 days, if he's going to drive like he sometimes used to when he was playing, he used to drive to the away games. It might mean he's going to miss the game before. You can't have that inconsistency as an assistant. He got away with it as a player because of the player he was. And he was such a committed professional that he could play and then either get chauffeured or get someone driving through the night and miss training sessions. And they trusted him to do that because he was a consummate pro. But you can't have that as an assistant. So, I mean, my question remains, what job do you have him do?
Yeah.
And then also, I think another point I would like to make, and this isn't 100% true, but generally when an assistant goes, like when a manager goes, the assistant goes with him. So it's not just Dennis that's been fired. It was the manager and also another coach. So the argument may have been, or the disagreement may have been, absolutely nothing to do with Bergkamp, but it's very uncommon for a manager to go and their assistant remain in place, because each manager wants their own man by their side to carry out things their way. So it may not be, Bergkamp may have done nothing wrong or may not even be involved in this disagreement. I mean, I'm trying to think of, it's obviously difficult with Arsenal because we haven't changed our manager for so long, but I'm trying to think of the last time a new manager came into a club and kept previous assistant, and it's really not
Ryan,
common.
Ryan Giggs at Manchester United, wasn't it? He was there for Louis van Gaal. Oh no, then Mourinho second, didn't he?
And he wasn't Fergie's assistant, Giggs. So no. He came in, and he wasn't Moyes' assistant. He came in as Van Gaal's assistant. He was in the coaching staff. He's never been the number two. Again, I'm trying to think. So thinking of recent changes, when Pulis got sacked, Megson was his assistant. Megson came in and done the job. And then when the new manager came in, Megson went. So again, they didn't keep the number two. The one I think of actually is, only because I know the guy, is Leicester. They sacked Shakespeare. Yeah, but his assistant was a guy called Michael Appleton. And Appleton stayed under Puel. I'm not sure if he's still number two, but he was only brought in this summer, and he was brought in by the club. It wasn't an Appleton, obviously. Shakespeare obviously agreed to it, but it was a club decision, He wasn't brought in by Shakespeare to be his number two. He wasn't earmarked. But you look at Allardyce, the first thing he's done, and he does it everywhere, he's bringing Sammy Lee with him, who goes everywhere with him. So he's not kept.
I was going to say, on Everton, didn't they retain Duncan Ferguson as well?
Yeah, but he was never the assistant. The assistant is literally the manager's right hand man, and I don't know many people that go to a job and go, if you had the choice, obviously you want your right hand man who knows how you work and does things your way, rather than a bloke that you have to teach on the job, especially in a job that's this important, and the lifespan of a Premier League manager now is so short that you need your team on board from day dot. You can't come in and start treating them again. Like Moyes came in at West Ham and brought three assistants. He brought Irvin, Pierce, and someone else who I can't remember. But he's come in and brought his own people. And so that's the thing with Dennis. I'm just trying to put a point that Bergkamp may have actually been nothing to do with the argument.
Just disagreement. The manager left, so he went with him.
Yeah, essentially.
Yep. Okay. MAA Gaming, another regular. Tony, if Giroud leaves in January, is there any way that Lucas Perez can return from loan?
As far as I know, he doesn't have a release clause. He has a clause. for a fee in the summer. I'm not sure what that is. So it's just because the time there wasn't time because we fucked about for so long to get the deal completed in August by the deadline. So they done it with a loan deal with an I'm not sure if it's an option to buy or a they have to buy. I can't remember the word. Right. So I'm not sure if it's that, but as far I'm almost certain there's no release. There's no recall clause.
Okay, stick with you, Tony. Lazy boy, what are the chances that we'll bring somebody in, multiple players in January, and what type of players?
difficult one. I know I heard in sort of the back end of November that we was looking at one quite big name or quite big fee. Don't know who it was, don't know what position. Everyone assumed it was in someone to replace Sanchez. I don't know whether things have changed due to the scout coming in. I mean, a lot of people are saying, oh, now this scout's coming, we're going to sign X, Y, and Z. I think we're more likely, with a new scout, we're more likely to sign not unknown players, but smaller names, because the big names, as I said, everyone knows about, and they know if it fits. So them targets don't change, but there may be some players around sort of the 5-10 million mark who have gone under the radar that the scouts notice when he's been out and about and doing his job. So there may be some lesser players. I don't know this, but there may be some lesser players coming in. But position and that no one knows. But as I said, I did hear a while ago now, nearly 6 weeks ago, that we was looking at one big-ish name. But looking at and getting over the line are so far apart that I'm definitely not going to sit here and say we are 100% signing a big name.
I know
they look him.
What's happened with this lad from Sevilla and Zonzi?
His agents are still touting him around, and
I've seen pictures of him in London or something during the week.
Yeah. So it was known he'd travel over to London. As far as I know, we don't have interest in signing him. It could be wrong, but his agents are touting him around. He spoke to quite a few clubs. I believe he spoke to Everton as well. Could be wrong.
Yep.
Obviously, they've got a fair bit of money now. He's not playing at Sevilla. They don't want him there. By the sounds of it, he doesn't particularly want to be there. It depends what his motivator is. If his motivator is money, then he could go to pretty much any team in the Premier League, bar maybe Huddersfield and Brighton.
He's got a kid in London or something, has he? Because I heard something about visiting his kid or something as well.
Yeah. So he's still got family over here, whether it's in London or just England. But he's still got family over here from his time obviously playing in the Premier League. But as far as I know, that his agent spoke to us. We're not really interested. We don't see that he adds anything. And that's as far as it goes concerning Arsenal. As I said, it could be wrong. Plans could have changed, or they could have not been the plans at all, and I've been misinformed. Okay. But as far as I know, we're not in the race for him.
Okay. Sorry. another regular one come in from Vish. Schwinn, we'll give you this one to you, mate.
Slap it on me.
Personally, I prefer Maitland-Niles to play in a central... Oh, fucking hell. Come on, Vish. Pull your head in, bro. Oh, mate. Hey, I'll read the question here. Personally, I prefer Maitland-Niles to play in a central midfield along Wilshere to bring the ball out from the back with Niles sitting back to your cover defence using the pace to neutralise... Mane, Salah, yeah, go for a tweet.
I think the key word there is personally. So if it's a statement, then I'm not going to argue with it. If it's a question, then I will argue with it, because there's a lot that he's said there, and there's a lot that he's not said there, which he's trying to insinuate. Number one is that he's trying to remove Granit Xhaka from that midfield. And again, I'm sitting here pulling my hair, as I said earlier. Granit Xhaka will play in our Premier League games. There's no removing him, at least till the end of the season, unless something catastrophic happens and Wenger is like, nope, I'm going to give up on this guy. But he is going to be a part of our future for the foreseeable future. Ainsley Maitland-Niles has done extremely well. I don't want to take any credit away from him. He's playing out of position as left back, which is quite far from what his, I would say, natural instinct is. He's a right-footed central midfielder, I would say, from what I've read and heard of him now, that he's played in the youth academies and coming up the ranks. he's done extremely well. He's been our best crosser of the ball over the last two games, if you look at the whole season. I think he completed more crosses in that one game in West Ham, that we played against West Ham, than Hector Bellerin and Kolasinac have completed throughout the season so far. That might be a bit of a stretch, but I did read that somewhere, so it might be wrong as well. I don't know how true that was. But to thrust him into midfield against a devastating attack that Liverpool poses, with Jack alongside him, who is more of an attacking midfielder, would be catastrophic and would be disastrous, to say the least.
And I do apologise, Vish. I am only laughing because I can picture Niles like a deer in the spotlight at midfield. I just alongside Jack, with a fucking raging Liverpool coming down at you. I just don't think it'd do the boy any confidence.
Yeah, I mean, bring in the cavalry, right? I mean, I really like one part of Vish's question, which is that he's investing so much trust in Niles. I love that. I've always been a bit advocate of bringing people from within the ranks and giving them a chance, at least long-term, to see whether they are able to cope up, whether they are able to grow, because that's an indicator of where things will go from there. You know, you might have the physical ability, but the mental ability to come back from losses, from injuries, when you're playing in the Premier League, is what defines you and is what defines your career. So I love that he is investing so much trust in Niles, having just seen him over two Premier League games and maybe five or six Cup games. So I do like that about that. But and to be honest, Wenger has fallen for this numerous times when educating young kids. So I can also see precedent for that question that Vish has put up. So I can see why he's thinking that way, and I appreciate it. But I think it would be a big, big mistake if things go wrong, and for which the probability is higher than things going right if Niall starts alongside Jack Wilshere.
Well, if he did, if we lost the game, they'd be asking for Niles. And I don't know whether Vish, because he's obviously a fan, fans would be saying he shouldn't have started there.
Yeah, and the person who's going to get the stick is going to be one. It's not going to be Niall.
Yeah.
I mean, Niall's just going to suffer from a blow to his confidence. That's needless to say. All the question marks will be faced by Arsene Wenger, and I think he is wary of that. I mean, I think there's very low probability, if any, of Niall's featuring in that midfield, especially when our players are fit. I would expect Coquelin to start over Niles if Xhaka was missing, for example. So it's a long shot. Unless it was completely propagated by injuries, I could not imagine Ainsley Maitland-Niles right now starting in the middle of the park against Liverpool.
Okay, Tony, this one's for you. Zane Ali, any news on the ownership of Arsenal?
I think I've mentioned this before on here. I don't know whether I have, or it's just when I've been talking to people in like DMs and stuff and inboxes on Twitter. But
I think we touched on it a few podcasts ago. But yeah,
well, all I was going to say is that it's a multi-billion-pound deal. These things don't happen overnight. They don't even happen in the space of a week. They take months, if not years, with the complexity of this deal. So I know, obviously, I tweeted about it and we spoke about it on here, but it's not one of them things where there's going to be an update every week. It's not going to happen like that. I don't know if any of our listeners, and I don't know if it's different in other countries, but when I bought my house, it took 4 months to complete. My house is probably worth less than 1% of Arsenal Football Club.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's definitely worth less than 1% of Arsenal Football Club. So, and that took 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the type of complexity you're dealing with. And also with my house, as a useless analogy, there was a buyer and a seller, and that was it. With the football club, there's a buyer and a seller potentially, and there's potentially multiple buyers and multiple sellers because different people own shares. But there's also contracts all over the place with something so small that people might think of. Look, obviously, everyone thinks of the sponsors and the manufacturers, but then you've got caterers who there's a long-term contract with. You've got whoever does the stewarding. I mean, it happens to be the same company as the caterers, but you get the point I'm making. There's multiple contracts all over the place. We've got, I think it's at last count, something like 35 sponsors varying from match day sponsors to our official watch partner if we've still got them, official car partner if we've still got Citroen there, I don't think we have any more, our official bookmaking partner. All of these things have to be considered. So it's nothing. It's not anything that there's going to be one day I'm going to come on and go, it's all done now.
Yeah.
It is a long, long process. I even think a year would be, I think I'd be surprised if we're sitting here this time next year and it's done. I still think that's, I still think that's too short a time frame. What I wouldn't be surprised by, and I'm surprised it hasn't already, I'm surprised it hasn't broken the press. I would expect it to probably in January, because as soon as we're not spending as much as some people want, someone will pipe up and say, if we had this board, that board, these people are trying to buy the club and they'll invest X amount of money. But it depends how far they are down the line. If they're at a point where they think they're going to get an agreement, then they don't have to, they won't break it in the press because they don't gain anything by doing so. They just make it public.
Mm.
But usually when things go public, it's to try and pressure one side. So it's trying to. So when it went public in May, I think it was, with Usmanov, it was because he was nowhere near getting a deal. Kroenke was never going to deal with him. And he wanted to get the fans on board. So it went public, and then he wanted the fans to put pressure on Kroenke. And it didn't work, but to an extent it worked. The fans put pressure on Kroenke. It's just he had his number and he wasn't going to sell for that. But that's the only reason you go public with these kind of things. If they feel they're in a place where a deal is going to happen down the line, then it won't go public. Because there's no, what is the benefit? What is, in all honesty, what is the benefit of me knowing?
There's no benefit at all. Nothing.
Yeah.
No. Exactly. Why would I want to tell anybody?
Yeah. And until they're very close to it, unless they need the public support, until they're very close, I don't think it will come out.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, thank you, everybody, for your questions. And, look, they are. Schwinn said to me during the week, he says, it's one of my favourite segments. He said, answering the questions with the controversy and whatnot. So, that, no, it's really good. Thank you, and keep them coming. You can follow us at clockend_talk. Okay, Schwinn, so you're going to... We've got Liverpool, Crystal Palace, West Brom, Arsenal, Chelsea. So I won't be back till after the Arsenal-Chelsea game. So whether Schwinn takes the reins in and around then, that's up to you, buddy.
Yeah, I'm going to try and get the boys together. I know Savvy is going to be back after Christmas, so he might be around. I know Tony will always be interested to join in. So we'll have a word amongst ourselves, and we'll let all you guys, all our listeners, know what we're planning. So you'll find out. We'll send out a request for questions and all that spiel. So hopefully we see you guys soon, and we have something exciting coming up for you guys.
Excellent. And, look, wish everybody a Merry Christmas this time, Tony.
Yeah, so I wish everyone a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. If I don't speak to you before, I probably will do, but let's hope for how many points there is between now and then. Liverpool, West Brom, Palace, 9 points will do. Forget all the rest of the Christmas presents, that's all we need.
That's all I'm happy with, mate. I'd be happy to come back and after Chelsea game and, 3, 6, 9, 12 points, thank you. Okay.
And another note, yep. If you don't win tonight, don't let it ruin your Christmas, because, I mean, it probably will mine, but there is other things in life. Just they're not as important as football.
Yes. Okay. Righto, thanks, boys.
Thank you.
Thank you. Cheers.
And you've been listening to the Clock End Talk. You can follow us at clockend_talk. Merry Christmas and see you next year.